2007.
Did he gavel in?
He did.
You just gaveled in.
I didn't hear it.
I didn't hear it. Now we close the hearing. Great.
Today is June 19th, 2017. June 20th, 2017. This is the House Committee on Rules. Today is a public hearing on House Bill 3458. We'll go ahead and open up public hearing on House Bill 3458.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3458 directs employer and manufacturing sector to pay greater of daily or weekly overtime when employees eligible for both in same work week. It defines work week for purposes of calculating weekly hours worked. It declares that employers satisfy certain overtime laws by paying greater of applicable daily or weekly overtime, prohibits employer from requiring certain employees work more than 60 hours in one work week, requires 10-hour rest period between certain work shifts, creates private cause of action to enforce certain overtime laws, authorizes court to award cost disbursements and reasonable attorney fees to prevailing party for violations of certain overtime laws. You do have a -5 amendment. The -5 amendment allows employee engaged in manufacturing to work up to 72 hours per work week if employer is eligible for undue hardship period exemption. Establishes requirements employer must satisfy to be eligible for undue hardship period exemption. Requirements for employer to be eligible for undue hardship period exemption involves processing perishable products after harvest, catch, or slaughter. Undue hardship period cannot exceed 90 days in a calendar year. Provides notice to bully. Obtains written consent from employee who will be requested to work up to 72 hours in a week. Clarifies that court shall enter judgment of actual damages or $3,000 per claim, whichever is greater, if employee prevails in private action. Adds award of liquidated damage equal to twice overtime wages earned. Clarifies that attorney fees may be awarded only to prevailing plaintiff. Clarifies that Bureau of Labor Industries may assess civil penalty of $1,000 for violation of overtime provisions. And clarifies that overtime exemption in manufacturing mills and factories exists in case of emergency where life or property is in imminent danger. We do not have a fiscal nor revenue on the underlying measure nor the -5, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. With that, we'll call up Senator Knope and Senator Taylor.
Thank you. Hello, Vice Chair Rayfield. No Williamson today?
You had to look at my name?
I did. Not really. It's been a lot of time, you know? I miss seeing you all the time, etc. So I'm just hoping
that's such an impact on her.
So, members of the committee, Kathleen Taylor, State Senator, District 21. We're here to talk about House Bill 3458, and I know there's been a lot of conversations about how this came to be. We started out over at the House with what's called the overtime bill, and then there were some other changes that were made, and due to relating clauses, and et cetera, we find ourselves here today with one bill with some different components in it, and I understand that there are some amendments that are being considered, and I just want to go ahead and put on the record that I'm open to and so I think I can't speak for Representative Holvey, but open to having some additional conversations if needed. So here we go. So House Bill 3458 addresses daily and weekly overtime calculations for manufacturing employees by coordinating with two statutes that the business community had sought clarification on. For many decades, Oregon law has required employers to pay time and a half overtime pay for hours worked over 40 hours in a single work week. For even longer, Oregon law has required manufacturing employers to pay time and a half overtime pay for any hours worked over 10 hours in a single day. House Bill 3458 states that employers in this sector are only responsible for paying whichever of the two calculations between daily and weekly are greater, instead of paying time in one half and half time on the other. In the hearing on the original overtime bill, we heard from employees who had been required to work more hours every day than the law allows, and advocates are concerned about overwork in this industry because of safety concerns. As a result, the Senate supported the following package of policies: stronger penalties against employers who illegally make employees work more than the maximum daily and weekly hours, right to rest between shifts for employees of 10 hours in between shifts of 8 hours or more, with exception language as requested by the employer associations, new weekly max for general manufacturing employees of 55 hours unless an employee requests or consents to work up to 60 hours. In such cases, the employer shall not require or allow the employee to work more than 60 hours in a work week. It is my understanding the Dash 5 amendment addresses the needs of manufacturers that work with agricultural meat and fish products and other perishable products. This amendment allows for those employers to schedule workers up to 72 hours a week for up to 90 days in a calendar year. This is new to the package because the current concerns were not raised in the Senate Workforce Committee. An employer would claim undue hardship under this provision of the law. The employer would inform the worker of the dates they could be expected to work beyond the 60-hour cap, and the worker would sign a document stating they understand that arrangement. Foley would be informed of the time frame that the employer is claiming the undue hardship. The bill also prohibits retaliation against an employee for provisions in the statute, and it defines the work week more strictly.
Please, Senator. Thank you, Vice Chair Rayfield. I did not look at your placard. And Vice Chair McClain, is that right?
Yes, Senator.
Oh, thank you. I am State Senator Tim Canope, Senate District 27, which I represent Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, Sun River. It is great to be with the House Rules Committee this afternoon. I see a lot of familiar faces and look forward to working with you on House Bill 3458, which used to be Senate Bill 984. How things change in the legislature. So what we tried to accomplish with 984, now House Bill 3458, was a consensus product, and I really appreciate the process that Chair Taylor set up on the Senate side in order to help facilitate the negotiation for a consensus bill. And there was a lot of hard work that went into the agreement so far, and included AOI, OBA, as well as the grocers and Oregon AFL-CIO, specifically. There were some significant work done by a lot of people, including Jess from FL-CIO. I think she did a lot of work on this. And the committee has been kept apprised of the situation since the bill left the Senate. And, of course, we needed some other elements to the bill in another bill, which happens to be this one. And so now that we have a combined bill, I think it's important that we recognize the work that's already gone into it. And Senator Taylor went over the specifics of the bill, so I would not be redundant in that regard. But I would just say that there was a lot of hard work that went into all the consensus that has happened so far. And I'm hopeful that this committee can work in a bipartisan way to figure out the remaining elements that that may be necessary to be addressed. And I think there are people that will come behind us that will address those. But I do appreciate the effort, the work that went into this so far, and look forward to your committee completing the task that I think is so important in terms of a fix for the overtime issue. So thank you for your willingness to take up the bill, and thank you for giving us the opportunity to come and talk with you today.
Yeah, questions? Sir, thank you very much. We'll go ahead and call up Betsy Earls, Amanda Dalton, and Jessica Gianetto.
Vice Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, Amanda Dalton. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association, and we represent grocers and retailers and manufacturers and suppliers. Just a little bit of brief history on how we got here. So we came to the legislature seeking a fix in the overtime statute, specifically what was originally contained in Senate Bill 984 and now 3458, lines page 3, lines 5 through 15, and page 12, lines 9 through 18. This language addresses what we call the overtime fix, and just a bit of background on why we believe this fix is necessary. Essentially, there are two separate statutes in the Oregon law books that address overtime for manufacturers, one that addresses daily and one that addresses weekly. While the statutes were adopted decades apart, there was never a statute to come in and address how the two would work together. For years, BOLI has provided employers with technical advice, which really has been our primary source of information to say, calculate daily and weekly, and pay the greater of the two. In December of last year, a lawsuit was filed against one of our employers, alleging, amongst other things, that they had miscalculated the way they calculate overtime. A few weeks later, BOLI updated their employer's technical manual to say that they did agree that they had been kind of misadvising employers for years and that you should calculate daily and weekly and pay both. Fortunately for employers, a Multnomah County Circuit Court judge in March of this year agreed with us and believed that the original interpretation of the statute, the two statutes, should be that you calculate daily and weekly and pay the greater of the two. And so while we find ourselves in a position of having a circuit court opinion, we are a little concerned and operate in a bit of a gray area across the rest of the state. I did put that opinion on OLIS for you if you'd like to read it. I think it's important to, there's a specific quote that the judge says regarding BOLI's pre kind of December 2016 interpretation. It, quote, creates a consistent reading of the statutory scheme by treating an overtime hour as something that must be paid at the rate of time and one half, the regular wage, once in all circumstances, not twice. And so that's essentially what we're here asking for, that paragraph that I mentioned that's referenced now in both statutes that will connect the two, that we believe is necessary to kind of address this gray area. And just briefly, some other components of what's in 3458. As you have heard, this does represent a heavily negotiated document, one that, in our opinion, has only been made better by the Dash 5s drafted by Rep. Pulvey, which do allow for a harvest exception with a higher weekly cap of 70 hours for 90 days. You will likely hear that that does not address all concerns. I do want you to know that on behalf of the grocers, the 60-hour cap does address the majority of our members. We primarily operate on 412s, which gets you at about 48-hour work week. 60-hour cap would get us at a 5-day, 12-hour work week. And there are occasions when a large order comes in or a perishable product is being processed that additional hours are needed, and we do believe that that increase to 72s will be helpful. So with that, I probably stole your entire testimony.
That's quite all right. Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries and Oregon Business Association. As you've probably heard this session, AOI and OBA represent approximately 1,600 members statewide. Many of those are manufacturers of varying sizes. As you know, AOI has been seeking a solution to this problem you just heard about of calculating daily and weekly overtime hours for manufacturing employees since the very beginning of session and even before. So we have done a great deal of work on the bill in the Senate. I'm not going to go back over the reasons that we're here, but we proposed Senate Bill 984 in the Senate to deal with the problem that many of our manufacturers have. And many of those manufacturers, for by way of example, run a schedule of 3 12-day work weeks, 3 12s 1 week, and then 4 12s the next week. So if you're a manufacturer that does that, you end up with 1 week that doesn't have any weekly overtime in it, and the following week has some daily and some weekly overtime in it. So the BOLI interpretation that you just heard about would impact them in terms of how much overtime premium they were having to pay. So it's quite a serious problem for most of our manufacturing members. We did, as I said, a great deal of work on 984 in the Senate and agreed to a series of worker protections that I think you'll hear a little bit more about here. Those protections are a significant change for manufacturing employers, and to be perfectly frank, some of those aren't going to be easy changes to make. Throughout the process, I have worked very closely with AOI's Employment Committee, which is composed of manufacturers, service providers, and some employment defense attorneys. These members have looked at every iteration of the bill up to now and have agreed that although there will be challenges in complying with 3458, House Bill 3458, on balance, we need the overtime fix that Amanda referenced. We need the overtime fix that you see in 3458 and feel that it balances out any challenges that we see with those worker protections, and therefore we are appearing before you in support of the bill as it is today.
Vice Chair Field, members of the committee. My name is Jessica Genetino, and I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. The Oregon AFL-CIO represents 300,000 working men and women in the state, and we're a voice for workers throughout the legislative process. We are in support of House Bill 3455 with the Dash 5 amendments. As everyone has now shared with you, this conversation began on the Senate side with Senate Bill 984. In our view, Senate Bill 984 was not only a rollback of a recently won worker right, but would have reduced the amount of money that workers got to take home at the end of the day when they worked overtime, just in the manufacturing sector. And we really viewed that as the only protection at the time, protecting the workers in the manufacturing sector against overwork in what we know to be a really dangerous industry. According to a study by the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, overtime and extended work shifts from 2004, a pattern of deteriorating performance on psychophysiological tests as well as injuries while working long hours was observed across study findings, particularly with very long shifts when 12-hour shifts were combined with more than 40 hours of work a week. Additionally, from the Bureau of Labor Statistics from 2015, we know that the manufacturing sector sees the second highest rate of workplace injuries nationally. And those type of work shifts in this type of industry is exactly what this bill aims to prevent. It provides both employer clarification on overtime requirements while also ensuring that workers are protected. Senator Taylor went through the provisions that are provided in House Bill 3458, but I wanted to share with you the reasons for some of those worker protections because it's not very clear when you just look at them on their face. What you'll find in House Bill 3458 in the Dash 5s is a stricter definition of the work week. Good employers don't, but unfortunately we do see some employers that will change the start of the work week to calculate a lower time of overtime that's owed to employers when a violation is alleged. That definition is what was currently in statute combined with what was in rule, so it was easy for employers to follow. Another thing that you'll find in the bill is a 10-hour right to rest between shifts 8 hours or more. When we were on the Senate side, workers came in and testified that we're working multiple 13 or 12-hour days, going home for 3 to 4 hours and being called back and not feeling like they were in a position where they couldn't say no. The shift provision that is 8 hours or more is built in to provide flexibility for employers, realizing that sometimes these manufacturing employers need to get something off the line, and it allows them to call folks in for a shorter shift than 8 hours without having to provide the 10-hour right to rest. Another provision that you'll find in the bill is stiffer penalties on violation of the daily cap. And the daily cap has existed since 1913, and the weekly cap. Again, good employers don't do this, but unfortunately we do see some employers ask employees to work beyond the current cap of 13 hours, and we wanted a way to dissuade them from doing so. And the last provision that you'll find that's a worker protection that's a bigger one is the new weekly cap, in which the rest of my testimony is going to center around. I think you may hear some concerns from seasonal manufacturers about the cap. To be clear, the Dash 5 amendments do show significant movement. It was not an easy task for the advocates to take to move beyond the 60-hour cap for these seasonal employers, but we did so once their concerns were raised. The Dash 5s create an undue hardship provision for manufacturers that process items that are agricultural crops, meat, and fish. These employers will be able to work employees up to 72 hours in 1 week, up to 90 days in a year. While making sure that workers understand how the law works and that and they would file the claim with BOLI. Just a little look back about these statutes that currently exist. Relying on little data to support what they knew was good policy to protect workers, the first overtime protections in the state were passed in 1913. That statute, in effect, created both a daily cap of 13 hours and a weekly cap of 91 hours. Now we have the luxury of knowing so much more about the negative impacts of overwork in what is still the second most dangerous sector. We can grant employers what they need in terms of clarifying overtime statutes and rate of pay while also ensuring that workers are protected in this industry.
Questions? All right. See. Yes.
Representative Smith Warner, when you're finished, please.
So I apologize. Thank you all for being here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize that I missed some of the opening stuff, but I know I've been getting kind of briefed about this on various folks. Because it is a kind of cross, not structural, but cross-organizational agreement. So it's been vetted now by all of your organizations and the ones that you represent, AOI, AFL, all that on this side as well, because I know there was an agreement. My understanding is there was a pretty thorough agreement on the Senate side that then had some significant renegotiations on this side. So the current, where it is now, has been currently vetted and okayed by all of your member organizations?
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith Warner, that's correct. I shared just before you came in, AOI has an employment committee of approximately 20 manufacturers, service providers, and employment attorneys. We worked with that group all the way through this process, and they need this overtime fix. And they feel like although some of the worker protections are new and challenging to comply with, on balance, it will be worth meeting those challenges in order to get the overtime fix. I do know that you're going to hear from some other industries later on that maybe don't feel quite the same way about that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Smith-Warner, yes, correct. Everything on the Senate side was vetted. The dash fives probably make it easier for the other folks that are testifying with me. They make it a little more difficult for our folks, but ultimately we got there because we still feel like they're good protections for workers.
Great.
All right, other questions for this panel? Sina, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll go ahead and call up David Dugan, Ellen Britton, and J.L. Wilson.
Hi there. Thank you, Vice Chair Rayfield and members of the committee. My name is David Dugan. I'm Director of Corporate Communications for Precision Cast Parts. PCC is headquartered in Portland, Oregon. We have nearly 5,000 employees in the state across 8 locations and 3 counties, Deschutes, Multnomah, and Clackamas County. So for years, we've calculated overtime pay the same way. I'm not going to rehash a lot. I think everybody can agree that we need the fix to the bully advice, and so I'm not going to go too deep into that other than to say that we supported Senate Bill 984. And we also support portions of House Bill 3458, which addresses the BOLI overtime advice and provides the needed clarity and clarifications that we need to have certainty in our businesses going forward. We are not opposed to mandatory overtime limits or the mandatory rest periods. However, we are opposed to the portions of House Bill 3458 that implements a cap on voluntary overtime. Restricting employees from working voluntary overtime is unnecessary and places restrictions and administrative burdens on industries, employees, employers where there are currently no issues. It's a solution in search of a problem. We do not utilize mandatory overtime at PCC. We utilize voluntary overtime. The way the process works is people are scheduled for their shifts, and then we post opportunities for overtime, and then employees would then sign up for that or volunteer for those. So just to make that clear, we do not use mandatory overtime. Our workforce is highly specialized. We have a lot of folks who are welders and inspectors and other technical jobs, well-paying jobs, living wage jobs, and again, nearly 5,000 in the state. For our employees, the prohibition on working hours over the cap reduces earning opportunities for these employees who are ready, willing, and want to work the extra hours for whatever the reason, whether it's, paying for college education for their kids, healthcare costs, a new house, whatever that might be. By restricting their voluntary work hours, voluntary overtime hours that they want to sign up for, it's unfair to them. Additionally, House Bill 3458's voluntary overtime cap fails to recognize the need for flexibility for the ebbs and flows in manufacturing. We have a lot of customer needs. PC is a complex organization. We have a lot of customers, supply chain. Occasionally, we have a need, and we want to post that opportunity for our employees to be able to work those voluntary overtime hours. The Dash 5 amendment doesn't work for us. It doesn't apply to our industry. It's actually unfair to apply it to a certain industry and not give us an opportunity, the flexibility that's needed within our industry to be able to run our business and have equal footing there. So not only that, but it doesn't cover employees that are covered by collective bargaining agreements. demonstrating the arbitrary and unnecessary nature of capping voluntary overtime. I submitted a letter on behalf of our organization, which you can reference, and it has all these details in it. But, you know, overall, we feel that we're fine with the mandatory overtime caps. We're fine with the rest periods. But we feel that the bill should be amended to eliminate the cap on voluntary overtime.
Chair Rayfield and members of the committee, thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Ellen Britton, and I'm my husband and I own Britton Vineyards in McMinnville. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Wine Growers Association. I'm past president and current board member of that organization, and I also represent my small family company. We farm 30 acres of grapes and make 3,000 cases of wine out in McMinnville. The OWA, Oregon Wine Growers Association, represents all the wineries in the state, small and large. There's over 700 wineries, but 75% of them are make less than 5,000 cases. So we are small, family-owned companies. While we thoroughly support Senate Bill 984 to solve the Boley ruling that requires double overtime, we are... as an industry, very concerned about the caps on total work hours per week, for a very specific reason for our industry. We are an industry that gets one shot a year at its raw material. It hits every year at harvest in the fall, and there's usually a two-week, possibly three-week window, but typically 2 weeks, looking back at employment records, where we hit a peak of work, and it happens once a year. It's a short-lived time, but our grapes are perishable. We're making a very high-value, high-quality product that's renowned all over the world, and every decision and every timing every timed action is critical to our product that we get to make once a year. And during that 2 to 3 week window, we do have people exceeding those overtime caps. These are highly skilled people who come in from all over the world. We put out notices that we're going to hire for harvest months in advance, and we get applications from all over the world for people who want to come take these jobs. They are seasonal jobs, and they want to make sure that they can make a significant amount of money during this window of opportunity, because typically they're in school the other parts of the year. They're working harvest in the southern hemisphere once more during the year. The rest of the time they would like to pay off their student loans or finish their educations and become winemakers. So these jobs are coveted, they're sought after, and the only complaints we get is if they don't get enough overtime hours during harvest. These are not folks standing at a conveyor belt or on an assembly line doing the same activity for 12 hours or 13 hours a day. They have varied activities, some labor intense, some cerebral. They may be doing manual labor for 2 hours and then doing lab work for 2 hours, taking temperatures on tanks. They have flexibility in their work day. They can grab a cup of coffee. We provide them with snacks. We bring in people to cook lunch for them. And if they work late, we bring them dinner as well. So I understand the protections that are needed for certain industries, but it doesn't apply to the wine industry. And we're a $3.3 billion industry in this state. And we want to protect our ability to make the best product possible. And the House Bill 3458 throws a big red flag up to us when we need just flexibility for a couple of weeks a year to get the work done and exceed those maximums. So we support the Boley fix on Senate Bill 984, but we do have some serious concerns about House Bill 3458 because of those seasonal caps.
All right, Mr. Wilson. Thank you, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing the Northwest Food Processors Association. We have 154 food producers in the state with 30,000 employees. We were the one industry that actually added jobs during the state's recession, so it is it's a viable and vital state industry. We did testify and supported Senate Bill 984. Subsequently, additional additions were made to the bill, and then we have House Bill 3458. We do not support House Bill 3458. The reasons articulated, or the add-ons to the bill, I want to be clear, we are fine with the right to rest provisions. We are fine with the penalties that accrue after a 13-hour workday. It is, in fact, the work week cap that causes difficulties for our industry and is prohibitive for our industry. There are at least five ways that I'll articulate for you that the work week cap is problematic for food processing, and I'm now talking about the 55 and 60 hour that are in the bill. I'm not alluding to the Dash 5 amendment, which I'll get to. One of the issues is seasonal demand. Obviously, much like my colleagues here on the stand, we have seasonal demand issues that obviously require work weeks in excess of 60 hours and oftentimes work weeks in excess of 72 to fulfill those very concentrated periods of time where there's seasonal demand. You have customer demand. The customer demand orders that are placed that require an increase in the man hours that are expended in order to get a product out in a timely fashion, and we are certainly going to surpass 60 and 72-hour work weeks based on customer demand for Oregon products. The third, which I think is probably the most profound, is simple labor shortages. This, at its core, is going to fundamentally disadvantage rural Oregon. The reason being, most of your agriculture is in rural Oregon. Your food production has to be in close proximity to your agriculture. And in many, if not most cases, those food producers simply do not have the labor pool to draw from in order to hire 24/7 shifts with 40-hour work weeks. They're going to rely on their pool of workers, their currently existing pool of workers, working more hours in order to get the product out the door. They don't have the luxury of being able to build up a robust enough workforce to put people in play and just limit their work hours to 40 hours a week. You've got transitions to new product lines. This happens when you've got a food producer that might produce one product for one season and then transition to another product in a subsequent season. That requires a period of transition and ramping up different processes, and that certainly would cause the 60 or potentially 72-hour work week to have undue problems. And then finally, you've got maintenance issues, and we've heard repeatedly that when the line goes down, you're putting people in play 24/7 in order to get production back up, and you're certainly going to run afoul of a 60-hour work week and potentially a 72-hour work week in those instances where you've got to you've got maintenance issues that you've got to get a product out the door. So I want to those are the five areas where I think that the bill interfaces with our industry and causes real problems. And I think you'll see production start to shift elsewhere if this is something that you're going to overlay on food production. I want to be clear with the committee that paying overtime on a 80-hour work week is a very expensive proposition. A company wouldn't just do this as a matter of course in their business model. They do it really because they have few options other than to do it. It would be much less expensive to be able to hire the workforce to keep people's work hours at 40 hours a week. But because you're in a place, a rural Oregon, and you have a limited labor pool to draw from, you don't have that luxury. And so employers aren't bending over backwards to put people to work 70 to 80 hours a week. It's an extraordinarily expensive proposition to do it, and they wouldn't do it if they didn't have to in many cases. The final thing I'll wrap up with saying is no employer wants to go ask Bowley for permission if they can work somebody up to 60 hours or work somebody up to 72 hours. I mean, the Dash 5 amendment sets up a process where you ask for permission to get from 55 to 60, and then you ask for permission again to go from 55 to 72. And, I mean, no one wants I feel like I'm trying to save us from ourselves here. No one wants to ask Boley to for permission to put people to work. And in many cases, I think if you have those instances where you've got production shutdowns and you've got customer demand that you didn't anticipate, I mean, the timeliness that this bill sort of lays out, that you have to get worker permission in order to get to these workouts, really just doesn't mesh with the reality of the workplace. I mean, businesses move at the speed of business, and trying to get navigate all these processes just to get permission for someone to work 72 hours, I don't think is realistic for how fast commerce moves. So that's our final observation about the bill. We are open to discussion as we've committed to the Senate chair, but as the bill stands now, it would be very problematic for our industry. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all for being here and for your testimony. I wanted to ask first from the woman in the middle from the wine. Thank you, Ellen. So you said you would have a 2-week period where there is this higher demand beyond the 72 hours.
Usually 2 to 3 weeks a year.
Okay. So you do know that in the Dash 5, there is specifically a hardship exemption for 90 days per year. So that sounds like that would deal with your problem.
I went back and looked at our last 2 years of harvest, and mm-hmm. we had both years we had people exceeding 72 hours for those two to three week periods. So what I was saying was 72 is not high enough for that 2 or 3 week period every year.
Okay, so if I may follow up.
Please.
So, but if these are in high demand jobs, that really sounds, unlike Mr. Wilson, who talked about that it being difficult to get more employees, you talked about how what desirable jobs these are. So if even that pretty large amount of, if even the 72 hours isn't going to work, which I would point out is like 10 and a quarter hours a day, 7 days a week, which when you add in 8 hours for sleeping is not a lot of other time. And I respect that it's a short, intense period. I've had plenty of campaign and other jobs where I worked 12 or 14 hours a day for weeks, if not months on end. I just, if it is such a, I mean, it sounds like you could resolve that with, by hiring additional people, particularly if it's a very desirable, if they're very desirable positions.
Representative Smith-Warner, that's a really good question, and I failed to mention that we hire these seasonal people for 3 to 4 months, so mm-hmm. they come from Australia, they come from different parts of Oregon and California and Washington. The job itself, the seasonal job, is 3 to 4 months. The peak within that seasonal job is 2 to 3 weeks. We start training in August. These are skilled jobs. So we can't grab a couple of people off the street for 2 or 3 weeks and throw them into our winery, one for safety issues, one for training issues, and one for quality control issues. So we start training these folks, even though they come to us skilled from other experiences, other wineries, and train them on our equipment, our systems, our processes, and we get them ready for this peak period, and then they ratchet back down, and we keep them on board typically to November. So they have a 3 or 4 month seasonal job that has a 2 or 3 week peak period in it. Otherwise, if it was something where we could just grab some temps or some extra people for 2 or 3 weeks, that would solve the problem, and it would save us money. So as my colleague here said, this is a very expensive thing that we have to deal with, but we really can't afford to staff up 3 or 4 months for a 2 to 3 week peak.
Okay. Representative Berto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So right now, I think currently it's 91, is it 91 hours a week that we can work, and then it's 13 a day. Are those 13, are they mandatory, or some of those voluntary hours? So it's like a 10 a day with 3 voluntary by the employee, or is it just 13 if the employer wants them to work 13?
Is that a question for me, Representative?
Anyone on the panel?
For ours, it's all voluntary. We have people fighting over the overtime hours. We try to send people home, and they want to stay and work longer, or they don't want a day off on that peak period because they have counted on that budget-wise to get as many hours into that short peak period as possible. So it's basically all voluntary. I can get any of those folks to easily work those hours, and it's never a mandatory issue that they have to stay and work. It's a very unique situation for a unique industry, and again, you would never want people doing that all year long. But for this short period of time, it's all voluntary, and they're really fighting over the hours.
You follow up?
Please.
Dave, at Precision Cast, do you have mandatory or just voluntary hours that they that your employees offer to work?
Yeah, we only utilize voluntary overtime hours. We do not use mandatory. So it's strictly voluntary.
And the 91 works with you?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Fulby.
Yeah, I was just curious when you were talking for Ellen about the 2 to 3 week peak period. So what is your maximum hours in that 2 to 3 week period?
I had the last two harvests, so 2015, I had three employees exceed a 72-hour week, staying under 91. One employee hit that 2 weeks. Two other employees hit that 1 week each. So we're talking about, I mean, we're a small winery, so I'm speaking for a 3,000 case.
So how many hours did they end up working?
They ended up working on the peak 85 hours 1 week, another 80 hours 1 week, 86 hours 1 week, 84 hours 1 week. The other 3 weeks, they were in the 50 to 70 range. So it goes up and then back down, and then we end up in the 50-55 range for a good portion of harvest. So it is truly, and then the following year I did the same, I went back to 2017, same thing. We had people working in the 72 to 80 hour range. We had five people hit that 1 week, and we had one person hit it 2 weeks. So it really is an intense short sprint as opposed to running a marathon.
Thank you.
Please.
And a follow-up for J.L. Wilson. You had mentioned that being a very burdensome to have to ask permission, you know, to Boley to work, to go over the cap. And I was looking through the bill and trying to figure out, I guess that assumes that Boley could deny your company to be able to go over the cap. And I didn't really see that in this bill that was actually permission. It looked more like it was that an employer just files a notice to Boley that they're claiming an undue hardship for those extended hours. But is it your interpretation that it's actually a permission that you're asking Boley that could be denied?
The way the bill's, thank you, Chair Rayfield and Representative Holby, the way the bill's laid out, as I understand it, you do seek the hardship permission from Boley, which I guess could be denied, and I think that is a problem. You then subsequently, it prescribes a form in which you would have to seek permission to go above the 55 and then again up to the 72. And so I guess the issue is I don't think it's right for employers to have to seek a hardship waiver from Boley to actually conduct business in the state of Oregon at the speed of which business is required, and that is a step that I think should be eliminated. If it was an issue of seeking employee permission, so it's voluntary, I think that we could certainly talk about that. I think most employers implement that practice.
Yes.
Good. I was just curious if Boley was signed up to testify.
They are.
Okay.
So, Representative Notes.
Thank you, Vice Chair Rayfield. So when I'm not doing this, I work at a labor union for the Oregon Nurses Association, and we've encountered this off and on, and we tend to work it out worksite by worksite, contract by contract. And it's a delicate tension. Sometimes people want to work, but there is a raging debate in the nursing profession, both about the sort of mental skill that's required to take care of patients and the physical demand of it as well. The running back and forth, sometimes the patients are very sick or very demanding or have difficulty with their mobility, and so it can cause, you know, there's all sorts of physical. So I guess what I'm trying to get a sense is, could the three of you describe sort of how mentally challenging the work is that people in the professions you're representing have to do and how physically demanding it might be. Because we do put limitations on airplane pilots. We put them on, we have a raging debate about whether or not we should do it for nurses. And, you know, there are limits to what people can do. And I've certainly worked 14-hour days for a few weeks in a row running for office, but I don't recommend it.
Running for office?
So I got elected, so it was worth it, I guess, right? But, I mean, so if you could just give me a sense of, like, that's my first question, is how mentally challenging or physically demanding is the work that someone's doing constantly? I just don't know.
I'd be happy to start. Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
Okay. So as I mentioned earlier, the type of environment we have, we manufacture investment casting and forgings and other products for the aerospace and energy market. So a lot of it, it's an industrial manufacturing facility. However, we take safety very seriously. We provide our employees with all the proper equipment and the machinery assist and everything else that's necessary. Some of it's automated. A lot of it is kind of fine work and welding and such. So I think we have a fine safety record. And again, we're not seeing any issues with, you know, and again, it's ebbs and flows with our business. Typically, it's maybe once or twice a quarter, a week or so, that we have some significant events where we have customer demand or orders that need to be processed. And so we publish that voluntary overtime. And so it's not a constant state by any means. And it is voluntary, strictly voluntary for employees who wish to. And again, we're in favor of the 10-hour rest periods and the other limitations that the bill has. But we feel that voluntary overtime hours should be voluntary and allowed. So,
regarding the wine industry, when you're in a winery, especially in the 75% of us who are small wineries, the jobs are all very varied from hour to hour and from day to day. So we don't have repetitive tasking. We have some physical movements. You're dragging hoses. You're moving pumps into position. You're getting wine ready to transfer from a tank to a barrel. And then you start the process, and then you're supervising or babysitting that so that you don't have a blowout of the pump or the whatever, and it might be standing there with a cup of coffee watching this wine move through, but making sure that somebody's watching it. You might start the day during harvest by doing punch downs. If you can believe it, I can do punch downs for 2 hours. It's physically demanding. You're in a tank punching down the cap, trying to get circulation in the fermentation, but then you may spend the rest of the morning doing temps and bricks, which is taking the temperature of each tank and measuring the sugar levels in the fermentation, which is very much more cerebral and much less physically taxing. So it is an industry where you have a lot of variety in a day-to-day hourly process. You're going through these different processes, some physical, some mental. Some might be being on a forklift moving barrels around, and we don't have the one person do the same thing for 12 hours a day. We shift people around into groups, or we give them different tasks every day. So if you did punch downs today, you're doing something else tomorrow, so you're not using the same set of muscles and you're not taxing yourself. It's a luxury that we have because of the type of industry that we're in.
Thank you, and Representative. No, I don't think there's any question that the work is rigorous. Just by virtue of the fact that you've got people on their feet and mentally engaged, I don't think there's any question that that work's rigorous.
All right. So then my one follow-up would be, please, is, so what do you do when you don't have a volunteer? Because again, even in the nursing environment, there's a patient that is sick and. Maybe the nurse is late, there was bad weather, this happens periodically, so someone can't get to the workplace, and so then there is, we don't have mandatory overtime in the nursing environment with the exception of a 1 hour window, but then there becomes pressure on that person to stay for all sorts of reasons. So how do you, I mean, I hear you say that there's no voluntary, that all the overtime is voluntary, but in my experience, there's voluntary overtime, and then there is like what you, there's a lot, there's sometimes there's a lot of pleading that goes on in that voluntary situation. And at least in the environment that I'm familiar with, is there's a way to offload and deal with that complaint sometimes, which is there's usually a union or a steward, or, you know, there's a vehicle to deal with that as opposed to having to file a bully complaint. So I'm trying to gauge how that works.
From our industry, it's we have owners and we have salaried employees. So the owners and the salaried winemaker, assistant winemaker, step in if there's not, if something needs to be done and there's not an hourly employee that wants those hours, we do it.
They do it. And then in the precision cast part situation.
So we don't typically have too many instances where we post a number of hours, voluntary hours, that we don't have volunteers for. Our employees, we have employees who want the voluntary hours and would see this as a takeaway with the provisions that they are in the bill. That said, you know, we don't twist their arm or have mandatory hours. Certainly, you know, if we needed to, we could certainly go to mandatory hours if it was a business decision that needed to be made. And then we'd certainly live with whatever cap that you guys put in place. But we're lucky enough that we have the employees that want the voluntary overtime and take advantage of it. So we certainly could go towards mandatory, but we haven't had to, quite frankly. So,
and the food processor situation.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rayfield and Representative Notes. There's so many variables in this across an industry that I don't know. I imagine, like you say, there's a voluntary and then there's voluntary. And I suspect if you're a food producer in a rural community, I mean, the option really is, do you saddle up and do the work, or do you does production falter and the company falters, and in many cases this is your a bedrock employer in that community. And so I understand what you're getting at, but I don't think that there's a real easy answer to that.
All right, with that, thank you guys very much. We'll quickly call up Paloma Sparks.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. For the record, Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. First, I wanted to quickly clarify the one piece that was brought up in the last panel. There was some discussion about the undue hardship provision and how the notice works. What would have to happen under the way the Dash 5 amendment, how it's written, an employer would make a determination that they met all the requirements for an undue hardship. They would get consent from employees to work those extra hours beyond the 55-hour cap. So the employees would consent. The employer then the only interaction with BOLI that would happen is that they would have to send us a notice. That could probably just be an unsigned copy of the consent form that they had the employee send. It's only so we have a record that they are claiming this undue hardship. There's no permission that is required. We can't grant or deny the fact that they're claiming an undue hardship. They claim the undue hardship, and that's how that would work. So there's been a lot of sort of confusion about who is an employee in manufacturing and who is not an employee in manufacturing. So that's why I'm here, to try and bring some clarity to that. On OLIS, you'll notice that there is a memo from Gerhard Teubel, who is administrator of the Wage and Hour Division at BOLI. I've also attached a copy of some of the rules, which talk about the exemption for who is not considered somebody working in manufacturing. I think the most important thing to understand is that it has to be somebody who's working directly with, one, that it's a raw product that then becomes something new. So there's a lot of confusion early on in session. You know, do people who are working in the nursery industry who are cutting down trees and bundling trees, is that manufacturing? No, it's the same product that it was before as it moves forward. Same with baling hay. There may be machinery that's involved, but you're not changing it to something new. So that's one element. And it needs to be happening in a mill, factory, or manufacturing establishment. There's a lot of history around that. There's a lot of information in the memo you'll see about that reality. So just to take a quick from our rules, manufacturing in this context is used in the rules means the process of making goods or any material produced by machinery. Anything made from raw materials by machinery, the production of articles of use from raw or prepared materials by giving such materials new forms, qualities, properties, combinations by the use of machinery. So that's really vague and complicated to understand, but the history of it is we're talking about what is actually happening in a mill and taking a raw product and making it into something new. Next, employees who simply work where their manufacturing may occur are not necessarily going to be covered under this provision. So there are a lot of exemptions in rules, but additionally, if somebody is, say, the office assistant, they work in an office, they don't work near the machinery, they're not considered employed in manufacturing in this context. Somebody who is a supervisor or a foreman is explicitly exempt from being covered under this law. So I think to keep it short and to probably answer more of your questions, I'll leave it to my written materials, but if you have additional questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thanks, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how long have we had the 91-hour potential work week, and why would we want to change that right now? Are there problems out there that we're not aware of?
Chair Rayfield, Representative Barreto, the 91-hour cap, if you will, be not being able to work more than 13 hours a day, refers to the 13 hours a day cap. So, and that dates back to 1913, give or take. I think that if you remember back to 1913, that was sort of a bare minimum.
Yeah, several of us do.
If you think back to your history books and what they describe to you about 1913 and working conditions, you know, that was the bare minimum of protections that people could put in place. We've had that in place for a long time. We heard a lot in the Senate committee about employees who felt like they didn't have a choice but to work all of the hours that the employer asked them to work. It didn't feel voluntary to them. It felt mandatory to them. This is not, the bill is not from Boley, but I can only tell you what I heard in the hearing.
All right, and we have to get some folks to some meetings, so we'll take one more questions, and then we're going to close the public hearing. Representative Hack.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Question as it relates to the hardship again. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that they would be required to submit a consent form from the employee. Is there a timeline for them to do that? Because if they don't realize that they need to have the overtime until the day before, and let's say that's a Friday and they're going to work a Saturday shift, Boley's closed, is there a process for that? And will there be any repercussions on employers if that timeline isn't met? Will there be a timeline? It seems like there's a lot left kind of lingering up to Boley to make those types of decisions, and how is that going to be done? Through rulemaking? Through what process?
Chair Rayfield, Representative Hack, So what an employer would have to do is send us a notice. They could send us just, here's the notice of that we're claiming. For ease, I thought it would be easier for an employer to just simply send us a copy of, an unsigned copy of what that consent form would be. We have other provisions that are similar, so we would pattern them after that. An employer has to get the consent from the employee before they will exceed that cap. In the current version of the bill, they would have to send that notice to Boley within 7 days of beginning to claim the undue hardship.
Can we follow up?
Just really follow quick. Up, and then we need to wrap up.
Okay, so if it's with, so it's within 7 days of actually utilizing the hardship. So they have to know 7 days in advance that they'll actually need the hardship.
Chair Rayfield, Representative Hack, the employer has to get consent from the employee before they begin using the undue, before they would claim the undue hardship.
But seven and then, days. Prior to needing the hardship is what you're saying.
No. So before you would begin to claim the undue hardship.
Right.
So that could be the day before.
Okay.
Then within 7 days of you having getting that consent, you need to send that notice to Boley. So you could already be using it. It just has to be within 7 days.
All right.
Sounds like we have some.
Yeah, I'll have you take that offline because it continue to go. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. Thank you very much. We're going to adjourn the meeting. Thank you very much. We're going to adjourn the meeting.